Greetings, and welcome to Talking Who to You, a podcast dedicated to the big finish audio adventures of Doctor Who. My name is JG Macquarie, and as always, I'm here with my co-host, Kev Kozar. Say hi, Kev.
Hi.
How are you this week? Are you ready to step into a gothic horror?
Well, I was going to plan a getaway with my old friends in order to undo the mistake we made 10 years ago, but I think that's a bad idea now after hearing this.
Yeah, it probably is. I'm sure I had a message from 10 years ago as well. I don't know where it came from. Now, anyway, this week we are covering Night Thoughts. So that means we are covering Seventh Doctor, Ace, and Hex in a story about a house in the middle of nowhere. Kev, do you want to give us a quick summary, please?
Sure. Night Thought begins with the Doctor, Ace, and Hex landing on a Scottish island and encountering a number of strange figures in an abandoned house. There is the Major, the Deacon, the Bursar, and a taxidermist named Hartley, as well as Dr. O'Neill, the first four longtime academic friends, who claim this is a place where they retreat, with O'Neill joining them for this year. In truth, the first four have been boarded up there for the past 10 years, trying to work on a time machine to send a message back to their past selves, prevent them from wrongly euthanizing, a young girl, which drove her mother to suicide and her sister to eventually run away, figure all this out, and come back as their maid, Sue, who is revealed to be Dr. O'Neill's daughter. Oh, and also during all this, there is a killer running around who might or might not be the dead Edie. And with all that creepy ghost atmosphere and story in place, we can begin our discussion.
So a nice, simple story with nothing too complicated to get our teeth into. You'd agree. What did you think of this one?
God, I really enjoyed it. And even more than I remembered, which is unusual for this podcast. And I don't know, not shade on Big Finish. It's just in general, I think if you're reviewing something that's different than, passively listening to it in bed, curled up, maybe doing something else. And I think you have to be more critical when you're like taking notes and thinking about something more. And some Big Finish plays, like, you know, I expect to like better in that mode, like Live 34, Nacho Sophia, a lot to dig into. But this was one I just remembered, that was interesting and nice. But this one really rewarded the revisit. And I was really happy about that because, yeah, it's not completely out of Doctor Who's wheelhouse, but this kind of very gothic horror with also a very supernatural twist. And when I put it like that, it sounds very in Doctor Who's wheelhouse. But still, I think the very ambiguous atmosphere really recalls the sort of late McCoy era vibe in a way that I wish Doctor Who'd returned to more.
Oh, no, I completely agree. And I think sort of, you know, the ghost-like comparisons are sort of inevitable since we have a small isolated location. We have like a single house. We have a small cast of characters. And yeah, we have that sort of borderline kind of supernatural thing. But I think sort of alongside that sort of gothic horror of Ghostlight, it sort of does recall some of the gothic horror from Doctor Who's past. But sort of normally when we talk about that, we sort of start talking about the Philip Hinchcliffe kind of era and Hinchcliffe and Holmes, but it's not really that kind of thing I think it draws in. I think it leans much more sort of towards Image of the Fendal, or maybe the first couple of episodes of Stones of Blood. It's got more of that kind of feel to it. So that, and that sort of incorporating that kind of supernatural, that kind of mythic, that kind of atmosphere, more than just mummies but they're robots kind of thing. And that's not like an insult to Pyramids of Mars, which of course is fantastic mostly, but it's a slightly different kind of gothic horror. And I agree with you. I wish Doctor Who would play sort of in this area a little bit more. I think especially if you have a look at the sort of stories that we've been covering lately, so, you know, Thicker Than Water, Terra Firma, the 8th of March stuff, Missy, whatever. It's been a really long time since we've covered anything which is going for like the atmosphere over everything. And that's really what this play is. I'm sure we'll have quibbles about the sort of narrative logic and sort of time travel stuff as we get through it. But what this is, first and foremost, is an atmosphere piece. It's about generating that atmosphere, the kind of the fear and the tension that goes along with it. And as far as all that stuff is concerned, I mean, this play is an absolute knockout.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I said, we will get into some narrative problems, but those are so secondary to how it very slowly builds tension and just releases it at like the most horrible moments. And I was also slowly building this mystery and really sort of resolving it in a way that where the answers both raise more questions, but also make you sort of more scared of what those answers could be than I think a very sort of pat technobabble answer would, which I think is a really smart thing this story does. So often in Doctor Who, we get the Doctor very calmly explaining why such and such a proton flows are causing the machinery to go haywire in such and such a way, and it's, you know, it can sort of deflate the tension a bit. With this, there's something great to how the writer, Edward Young, really doesn't let his answers be just solid answers. In fact, the story ends with the Doctor and Ace and Hex offering theories, but nothing definite. And so your own mind is left to sort of wander and think about what could have happened. And it's not a pretty answer if you assume the worst.
No, and there's no pretty answers here, which I think is the right sort of approach to take, especially when you're basing something like this on that kind of atmosphere, on the feeling and the creepiness and all that kind of tension that's built up in this household. If you're going to do that, I think giving it a sort of technobabble explanation, some kind of flood of bafflegab that just explains everything away in the last couple of minutes, it's going to feel pathetic. It's going to feel like it deflates the whole sort of purpose of it. And yeah, as you say, we have Hex and Ace and the Doctor offering possibilities, but no specific resolutions. And I think that is absolutely the right approach to take here. And I'm absolutely fine with Doctor Who when it operates in a sort of level of sort of symbolic logic rather than kind of narrative logic. And I think that's exactly what's going on here. And I mean, again, if we go back to the TV show, I'm thinking of sort of maybe the way that something like Warrior's Gate would work in the original, or maybe something like Kill the Moon even in the new series, which I know is a very controversial story. I love Kill the Moon. I think it's absolutely bloody brilliant. But it's definitely one which is operating on symbolic logic. It's not operating on real world or full science kind of logic. And that's exactly what's going on here. The idea that these concepts, especially when we start talking about sort of Happy the Rabbit and the way that that works, we have corpses inside bears, we have time travel via what feels like Bakelite telephones. There's so much really interesting stuff going on here, but it all feels really kind of symbolic. So the idea that they can send this message back in time, just take one sort of arbitrary example, it feels like that's kind of like it's a symbolic representation of the way that people fail to communicate with each other, as much as it is a kind of literal kind of time travel sort of explanation as they try to change the past to sort of avoid the euthanasia of this girl who didn't need it. And that's a really difficult balance to strike, because if you push it too far one way, you tip into kind of this just doesn't make any sense anymore and we're just covering it up. And I think we've seen that before slightly with maybe something like The Abandoned in the Fourth Doctor line. And if as I said before, if you sort of have this bafflegab ending, it just feels like, oh, well, that wasn't really in service in anything, and here's just a few quick words to try and explain it away. But I think this does a really great balancing act of just striking that, yeah, that balance between symbolic logic and kind of narrative logic and really packing the punch that comes with that.
I love that term, symbolic logic, and I don't know if I've heard it before, and it's great. I think it does such a good job of capturing what I like. I mean, to just back you up, I also love Kill the Moon. And
there's two of us.
Two of us, and not many else out there, but enough that we can sort of form a bit of a coalition. And yeah, I think it's bears mentioning that, this bit of trivia, let's get it out of the way. This was originally written to be a season 27 story, not one of the canonical ones that Cartmell lined out with, like, Rain Creevy that were later adapted into Lost Stories, but just another potential script for that season. And obviously readapted to incorporate Hex and to be four episodes instead of three. But what I think is important to bring that up is because that sort of symbolic logic is so over McCoy's final two seasons. Like, you look at stories like the aforementioned Ghostlight, Greatest Show in the Galaxy, Curse of Fenric. There are so many things that don't quite line up, but have this mystical air about them, this very uncanny air about them that is very unsettling, that I really love from that era. And this really sort of follows along while also going into even further than the outright horror than any of those stories. I don't know how much was changed for Big Finish, maybe increased, or if this script was submitted and would never made it to air in its current state. But Yeah, it is a very gruesome story, and it really benefits, I think, from that. Like, I don't want Doctor Who to be gruesome all the time, but when used thoughtfully and intelligently, I think a little bit of gruesomeness goes a long way.
Well, I think it's that intelligence which really makes this work, because it could come across, especially that very final scene at the end of episode four. We'll maybe talk about that a wee bit later, but that could tip over the line into sort of gratuitousness as sort of somebody's eyes are basically pulled out. It walks a really fine line between pushing that kind of horror element as far as it can go, but not just quite tipping over into that sort of gratuitousness or into that sort of exploitational sort of approach, I think. And that's really to the credit of Edward Young, who wrote this, that he's able to strike that balance so well. But this captures that atmosphere of season 25, season 26 so well. And I mean, so much of that is down to the script. I think a lot of it comes from McCoy's performance as well. He's so down in the mix here in terms of the way that he performs. Everything is sort of low. Everything is sort of very slyly delivered. He doesn't really have any big shouting scenes. He has a couple of slightly lighter moments when he teases Ace about her when she's got her legs stuck in the bear trap or whatever. But generally speaking, you know, he's all very much kind of, you know, almost sort of sotto voce. He's talking under his breath, and he's never really talking. Well, he hardly ever talks directly to Ace and Hex. He's almost either talking to himself whilst they're in the room and then they respond to him, or he's talking to the other characters. But it's a really great use of McCoy and that Seventh Doctor, because that, again, that captures that season 25, season 26 air. And when we talk about sort of symbolic logic, one of the ones that always comes to mind for me is Battlefield, which so freely mixes that idea of sort of Arthurian legend and science fiction. There's the mythic, there's the gothic, there's the historical, there's the science fiction, and it all kind of blends together. And I know Battlefield isn't necessarily the best regarded Seventh Doctor series, but I think mostly because of the production rather than because of the script. But this has that same flavor. You can feel the myth and the science fiction and the way that all these things blend together. And although in terms of, you know, sort of direct antecedents, Ghostlight is an obvious one to go for, there's just so much of this layered throughout McCoy's time in the role. And McCoy responds so well to this. These kind of scripts always get the best kind of performance out of him. And you can just hear how, I think, invested he is here, how committed he is to this script, and he just delivers a phenomenal performance in response.
Quick sidebar: speak if we're standing up for unloved stories, I'll also stand up for Battlefield. It's the worst of season 26, but it's still good.
Yeah,
It's just a
exactly.
great season. And yeah, specifically to McCoy, yeah, he's so good in this story. And I think this hardest thing to do is that scene where he's gone back 10 years and has to advocate for Edie's death,
Oh,
and
yeah.
so much emotion has to be played there. This resolve to convince these people to let this girl die, but then also the regret that has to shine through just a little bit so he doesn't seem like a monster, and he walks that tightrope so perfectly. It just makes things like that make me so happy that Big Finish exists, because we can get great performances out of Sylvester McCoy like that, and he is just wonderful in that scene. And yeah, the rest of it too, of course. He is mostly switching between the front seat and the back seat, knowing when to watch and listen, knowing when to sort of take control, but very rarely raising his voice, and that just gives him so much more power in some sense.
Well, I really want to focus on that scene a little bit as well, where he has to go back in time. I mean, one of the things with the Seventh Doctor and with sort of McCoy's portrayal of it, both in terms of the way that it goes in season 26, and particularly in the way that it sort of develops in the New Adventures, is that they are pushing this idea of a dark doctor. They're pushing the idea that he is going to be able to do things, or he's capable of things that we don't necessarily associate with the Doctor. And they're not things which are pleasant, they're not things which are nice, but they sort of help to give depth to the character. Having that scene where he has to go back and essentially advocate the death of an innocent character kind of takes that to a sort of extreme that I don't really know we've seen very much, especially not in Big Finish. And it makes you seriously question just how far this Doctor is prepared to go. This is always a Doctor who's scheming. It's always a Doctor who's got plans, wheels within wheels, whatever. And he's always seems to be focused on kind of the bigger picture. And that sometimes means, you know, that the individuals get lost in the mix. And especially when it comes to the Seventh Doctor, most famously, that happens to Ace in Paul Cornell's Love and War in the New Adventures, where she becomes a casualty of the Doctor's kind of big picture view of the universe. And so it's really interesting to put this Doctor in a position whereby he has that sort of question directly in front of him. There's no excuses, there's no big picture, we just need to see how far this Doctor is going to go. How far are we going to see the Dark Doctor develop to the point where he is going to advocate for the murder of somebody who he fully knows does not need to die, who he knows is an innocent victim of somebody else's experiments. And that's really powerful. And it gives such a boost again to McCoy's performance. But it's just the fact that they're prepared to take the character to that level, that they're prepared to interrogate the character to that sort of degree and in that sort of scene. You can question about the time travel logistics, and I definitely will be questioning some of the zombie stuff as we get in later on. But just in that moment, just the power that comes from that scene and being able to confront those elements of this Doctor directly, I mean, that alone makes this play worth listening to.
And it's very interesting that we get the sort of off-screen resolution to that, where he admits he doesn't go through with it. And I think we can all agree that would almost be a line too far if he did.
Yeah.
And it's nice how they keep that tension, though, because that is the closest, at least that Big Finish has done, where the Doctor has come to such like a horrific action. And I really like how they walk that line. And so you believe in through McCoy's performance and through the way Young scripts it and the way it's all set up that it could have happened. But then it makes the resolution where he says he couldn't go through with it like just a little bit more satisfying. It's almost like a sigh of relief. And I love that, as well as then tying into then how that creates a situation they're in.
Oh, absolutely. And I think all that tension comes from the fact that, yeah, you're 100% right when you say that would almost be a line too far. It would definitely be a line too far. But what makes it so fascinating is that this, of all Doctors, this one could do it. This isn't Tom Baker with two wires asking, have I got the right? This is, you know, this is a Doctor who really would make that choice if he thought it was the right thing to do. And that's where the tension derives from, the fact that we really seriously believe that this is something the Seventh Doctor would go ahead with. And he doesn't. And you're right, when we finally get that admission, it's, thank God for that. He didn't go too far, but they take him right up to that moment. And that's just brilliant.
I guess while we're here, we should talk about the other regular cast members. I really like Sophie Aldred in this story. Ace doesn't get much to do, but she has a lot of great lines. And I think Aldred plays a sort of tension well, where Ace is a very action-oriented character, and this is not a very action-oriented story. And I guess I do have quibbles where she's often put in a situation of distress and captured, but I think it's played off just by how like emotionally strong Young scripts her and how Aldred really plays it very winningly.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. And I think one of the things which is really obvious is how Sophie Aldred and Ace are now benefiting from the presence of Hex, because there's a certain relaxed kind of confidence to the way that Ace is sort of being delivered here. You can hear a lot of that in sort of Sophie Aldred's performance. We start to get a much more kind of sort of brother-sister relationship, I think, developing between Hex and Ace here. Or, I mean, if you want to say sort of, I don't know, whatever, mother-son or whatever it is. But there's definitely that kind of relationship developing where she's a slightly more seasoned traveler and she's comfortable with that. You can see that Ace is, that Hex is learning and he's taking cues from that. But she's not being put in a position where she's simply, she knows everything or whatever. She makes mistakes. She gets into situations that she can't get out of. I do agree that she's maybe becomes a bit of a pedal monkey maybe once or twice too often in this story. I think especially the whole bear trap thing, which is a bit of a feint and doesn't ultimately really go anywhere other than to provide episode 2 with a bit of a cliffhanger. That's a bit unfortunate. But that's not Sophie Aldred's fault, and she plays it well. And I like the way, yeah, that relationship between her and Hex is developing. And you can hear that Philip Oliver is becoming much, much more confident in the role as well. So he's also responding really well to how Sophie Aldred is delivering her role. The two of them, they just fit now. They just work.
Oh, for sure. And I definitely want to follow up on Hex, but I want to hit this really quick before I forget. All the cliffhangers in the story are really annoying. And
yeah,
it's a very unfortunate. They all are these very arbitrary setups. The door is stuck. Oh, a bear trap is in the woods. Oh, let's dig up a grave for some reason. There is a big reaction, and then the resolution is, oh, the door's unstuck now. Oh, I didn't land in the bear trap. Oh, the grave's just empty. And it's such a deflating moment at the beginning of every episode. I mean, credit where it's due, the final scene of the last episode, at least, is very gruesome and cool and chilling. But, the three cliffhangers, I guess a side effect of the story being much more about, like, dread and build rather than, like, actual action and events that are scary, is that Edward Young has to sort of juice them up with these various sort of artificial climaxes, and that is a little frustrating to go through.
This is definitely one of those stories where it's not something that I agree with all of the time, but there would be a fair argument to say, I think, that this might have been a story which was better as a one-parter and just ran for its length of time. The cliffhangers don't add anything to the story. They're just there because, like, every 30 minutes you need to have a cliffhanger, because that's how a four-part Doctor Who story is structured. And there's no great requirements. The cliffhangers are definitely the weakest part of this story. I think that's probably fair to say. And everybody's doing end of episode acting, which in one sense I quite like, but everybody sort of ramps it up for the last couple of 2 minutes. Oh, and then, it's fine. And it's like every single cliffhanger follows that quick rise up, and then no, it's actually nothing at all. And that's unfortunate, but honestly, it's not that big of a deal in this story.
Oh, not a big deal. Just like a little thing I wanted to pull at, because I find it almost funny how anticlimactic it is.
Yeah, no, you're quite right.
But back to Hex. Philip Olivier is so good in this as well. You're totally right about him and Ace having the sibling relationship now. I definitely go with her being the big sister to his little brother. And like the dialogue exchanges between them are so fun. I love especially the one where Hex comes across Ace tied up and is just a little gloating about it. Like, I get to save you now. And she has to, like, sort of banter off with him. Those little things show how these two are coming together so quickly and in such a satisfying dynamic. And it really does, like, make this whole TARDIS team really click. And, yeah, throughout it, Hex gets to really be the sort of emotional support for all these characters, as the Doctor and Ace are the more distant figures. And it really shows off why he's such a good addition to the TARDIS, because he gets to sort of console Sue/Ruth. I mean, the scene where he like hugs her after she sort of is processing all that's happened to her is so lovely and sweet, and only Hex could do it, especially out of this crew. But you could even say out of most companions, I mean, Hex is the sort of rare one who could pull off that scene. And yeah, it is such a wonderful little moment. There's so many little moments like that in this story that make a good argument for Hex's existence.
Well, absolutely. And I think one of the great strengths of using Hex's character that way is it gives Philip Olivier it gives him sort of material that he can get his teeth into. So we get the fact that he's a nurse here, and he gets to deploy those kind of skills and that side of his character very effectively. But that's not the only thing his character has to do here. I think one of the mistakes that often gets made with sort of companions or whatever when they're relatively new, or when people want to dig into it, is they'll take one aspect of that character, build the whole story around it, and then that's all that they get to do. But this is much more intelligently scripted. So he gets to be kind of understanding and compassionate towards Ruth because he's comes from a nursing background. He gets to have little lines like, well, you know, I don't think there's anything I can do for her now after somebody's squashed by a falling bear, because that's normal. But, you know, there's that aspect of his character is teased out, but that's not the only thing he gets to do here. I like that scene that you mentioned where he gets to kind of say, so now you've been captured, to Ace. It's also great because she gets to sort of do a big eye roll and go, yeah, it does happen sometimes. And it's just such a lovely interplay. And the way that sort of Philip Olivier and Sophie Aldred sort of spark off each other in those scenes is so great. They just have that kind of rapport down nicely. And it's so refreshing to have it played as like a kind of brother sister kind of thing, rather than, because especially with Hex coming on board, we don't know precisely how old Ace is, but we can probably assume maybe mid-20s by this point. She's been traveling with the Doctor for a while. Hex is not that different in terms of age. So it would have been fairly easy for this to kind of fall into a sort of romantic thing at this stage, or a will they, won't they, or something like that. But they avoid all of those cliches and they go for something different. And the fact that they have such an easy rapport, but it just develops into this friendly kind of big sister, little brother kind of thing. It makes such a nice change. And as I say, Sophie Aldred and Philip Olivier are so good at being able to play it that way. And it's such a pleasure to listen to.
Yeah, it is really nice that they never went the romance angle with Ace and Hex, because that would have been just so cliche and boring. And also, I don't know if Big Finish ever addressed the issue of Ace's sexuality, which I know is something like in question throughout when she was on TV and then sort of debunked by the Virgin novels. But, you know, canonicity being Doctor Who what it is, you take what you want. And I don't know if Big Finish has ever gone a hard line on that. I can't remember offhand, but I think that's also a little extra layer why I appreciate why it's played this way. Because, I mean, even if these writers don't see Ace as gay, it's just nice they have the little wiggle room there that just don't have a confirmation one or the other.
Well, absolutely. And I think it's one of those things, especially sort of in contemporary media. I'm going to go slightly off topic here. I promise I'll get back to Night Thoughts in a second. But it's one of those things that is both beneficial and sort of slightly unfortunate about the development of slashing, i.e. making sort of romantic pairings, because especially when it comes to sort of male-male characters on TV, you got this a little bit in Doctor Who with Captain Jack and the Ninth Doctor, or sort of Rory and the 11th Doctor. But that tendency to have characters, if they're gendered in that way, always suggest a romantic kind of, or a sexual relationship, rather than a friendship, or rather than something which is like maybe more sibling based or something like that. And it's not that I'm criticizing sort of queering or queer readings of particular things. I'm gay myself, so I'm kind of, I have an investment there, so that's my cards on the table. But it's one of those things that, you know, sometimes it would also be nice to have sort of male-male relationships sort of portrayed as something which can simply be good friends. Well, Legends of Tomorrow is really, really good at doing that. If anybody watches that, they're so good at being able to handle that kind of gender and friendship and sort of sexuality balance. But it's a real rarity sort of in popular culture at this point. So, as I said, I'll pull it back to Night Thoughts. The fact that Big Finish made this choice, and Big Finish have come in with a lot of criticism, I think a lot of it deserved, when it comes to the way that they approach gender, sexuality, transgender, and kind of other representational issues. But the fact that they chose to have the relationship between Ace and Hex be that sibling one, have them that they can just be good friends, and that good friends doesn't always have to lead to that kind of cliche will they, won't they, or whatever. It makes such a refreshing change, and it's such a grown-up way of handling it. Not everything has to reduce to one thing or the other thing. And I just really kind of want to sort of hit that on the head, just how much I appreciate the sort of restraint and the understanding of those characters as they're used.
I want to pull us off Night Thoughts for a second because of something you said. If you're listening to this and you don't already, please watch Legends of Tomorrow. It's the most fun show on TV. And
Since
you like Doctor Who, you would like Legends of Tomorrow, which is like Doctor Who, but they're all like criminals and leftists and just sort of rule-breaking weirdos. And, oh man, it's so much fun. Not that the Doctor isn't those things, I think about it,
show.
But such a blast, such a fun thing. And I know the continuity with the other CW superhero shows can get confusing, but you're a smart person with internet access. You can figure it out. You can even start on season two or season three, which are better than the first season, which is has a sort of so bad it's good quality. But yeah, by season three especially, and now the current airing season four, it's so much fun. So yeah, I would give yourself that sort of challenge to sort of dive into that show. It is a blast. You'll really enjoy it. Back to Night Thoughts. Now, once again, I don't know what I really want to talk about next. There's so many good options, but I guess let's get into the sort of other characters who live in this house. I really like how well they're all developed, given just enough sort of personality to sort of get you to connect with them. But then as they're sort of taken out in a... And then there were none, I believe, is the correct way to phrase the Agatha Christie story.
Yes, I think that's how it's diplomatically meant to be referred to now.
The new canonical name.
Yes.
As that sort of atmosphere it builds as they're slowly off one by one is so good at building the tension. And it does have that Christie quality to it where, yeah, the characters are well developed. And so that makes their deaths meaningful. And I really enjoyed that about the story.
Me too. And I'm again going to sort of refer back to the original show. When we're sort of talking about atmosphere and all those kind of things, because we also have Horror of Fang Rock, and we have a similar idea, again, in close space, characters are dying off one by one, but it does have that kind of murder mystery air that hangs about it. What's so great about this story is that we can reference all these stories, and we must be probably in double figures by now in terms of the number of just other Doctor Who stories we've mentioned. This never feels derivative, and it never feels like it's just sort of borrowing or stealing from those things. It's using, I've heard this expression before, I can't remember if it's from About Time or Elizabeth Sandifer, it's something like that, but it's somebody who's working from a folk memory of what Doctor Who is rather than sort of specific things. And I think that's why this is so good, and the way that these characters are kind of removed one by one, yeah, I can say that it refers back to Christie or that it refers back to Horror Fang Rock or whatever it is, but it's effective because it's able to draw on that sort of folk memory of the way that Doctor Who does this without it necessarily being a specific reference. Something, Robots of Death is another one. We have it's a classic kind of murder mystery in Doctor Who. Why did that just come to mind? I should have thought that straight out of the box. But it's exactly the same thing. It's an Agatha Christie story. People are getting killed off one by one, but this doesn't feel like it's just doing the same thing. All the characters here are great. And as you say, we have just enough investment in all of them to actually care what happens to them. So when we hear about the Bursar, when we hear about, what's going on in the Falklands, when we hear about sort of Major Dickens and his kind of sort of pompous, puffed up self of sense righteousness, it's drawing characters in broad stretches, but the characters are interesting, and we have more than enough kind of distance being made up by the performers. I mean, we have Bernard Kay here as Major Dickens. Bernard Kay is so good in this. He's great, and he's got such a long history in Doctor Who, and you know, he's able to really give the Major kind of, you know, real interiority, I suppose is what I want to say, if that's not too pretentious. He feels like a real character, even though kind of like the bluster and all the rest of it, well, these are kind of familiar sort of military characteristics, but we have so much more being invested in that character simply because of the quality of the actor that we have playing it. And I think that's true for all of the supporting cast here. They're all given that interiority. They all have that kind of extra lease of life that really makes you invest. So when they do start dying off one by one, you really care about what happens to them. You want to know why this has happened and who's responsible. And for any successful murder mystery, that's what you need. You need to care about the people who are dying in order to care about what happens when the killer is finally revealed at the far end of the story.
Since you brought up Bernard Kay, I guess let's hit on Major Dickens first. I think right out of the way, I say the complaint I have with him is his motivations are a little inscrutable.
That's fair.
It goes into a bit raving madman by the end in a way that doesn't quite make sense. But besides that, yeah, it's such a compelling character. Has this very sinister force in the house. And it's sort of that thing where he sort of slowly becomes the villain you don't even notice until it's too late. Especially the way Kay plays him with that very authoritarian attitude and like all bluster and all commanding. I mean, it really does sort of help like get, I guess, the people in line, so you don't really question him until it's again a little too late and he's like revealing he's orchestrated everything. And I do kind of like that once interrogated in that third and then fourth episodes, all these people sort of fall like a house of cards. That's almost realistic in a sense that you would when people start getting killed around you. And that's something to appreciate, that he's so forthright with, yes, I'm a madman and I'm trying to bring someone back to life from the dead with a time paradox. That, I mean, yeah, he's, I don't know, that seems so different than saying that while laughing maniacally and twirling your mustache, and so different than someone who is like, oh, I was doing it for the greater good, I'm sorry, this is how I see it. It's just very matter of fact, and I think with already the story being 2 hours long, that's what you need.
Well, yeah, it definitely is, and it's that self-awareness that makes me appreciate the character so much, because it would be, as you said, quite easy to have him sort of fall into maniacal laughter and mustache twirling, but he isn't. I mean, he's aware that he's a bit of a nut job in the end, and that's fine, because he is aware of it, and he's not, you know, he's not laboring under any false pretenses, he's not kidding himself that he's the hero of the story, or that he's doing it for anything other than what his own motivations are. Yeah, those are slightly cloudy. That's a fair criticism. But nevertheless, it is just refreshing to have someone who has that sort of perspective on their own kind of life and their own actions. And I think the way that the play kind of shifts him into being the bad guy kind of under our noses is quite effective, because especially when he's first introduced, I mean, he's that sort of pompous military buffoon. And, you know, we're used to encountering characters like this in Doctor Who. It's our immediate reaction to that kind of characters is, oh, God, right? And you're not encouraged to sort of get on board with him. You kind of want him to be the bad guy. You want him to be, you know, the one that finds out. But in an incredibly short time, and again, I think this has a lot to do with Bernie Kay's performance, that kind of falls away, and you kind of can't help but sort of warm to him a wee bit. And then gradually, as the sort of play wears on, as we get through the episodes, he gradually shifts just a little, and then just a little, and then he does finally become kind of the bad guy. He's the villain. But it's done so well. It's done so subtly. And that's a really great way of sort of zagging when we expect a zig. It really kind of plays with audience expectations. And that's just such a clever thing to be able to pull off successfully.
What I like about sort of tightrope act of like how these characters are treated and how we're supposed to feel about them is, like, you're right, we do warm to him a bit, even though he is a monster, and because he's well characterized. And all four of these people who wind up dying are very well characterized, but they also all have it coming. And it's kind of fascinating, a little novel, to have like a slasher story where everyone who gets slashed, oh, you think, oh, yeah, they probably deserve to die by this zombie killer. I don't think I've ever seen like a Halloween movie like that. And I really like that about this story. You really feel for all of them, and especially the Bursar, who I want to talk about next, a.k.a. J.J. Bartholomew. She's easily the most sympathetic of the four of them, and also has the most interesting backstory. And I just really love how Joanna McCallum, like, navigates that. This sort of person with, like, all this potential that she's sort of throwing away behind this project, and as the regrets pile higher and higher, it's so lovely what she does.
She's so great in this role. And as you say, yeah, the Bursar is by far and away the most sort of sympathetic character here. And again, we get her sort of played in that way that we invest in the character. So, you know, there's just such an easy kind of warmth to her. And it's impossible not to feel sort of sympathy for the way that she's sort of had to sort of sacrifice her career and all the rest of it. Like, even nice little details, like the fact that all of the books that she has in her library, the only ones whose spines aren't creased are hers, because she wrote them, she didn't read them. That's just such a lovely little detail. And again, that feels kind of sort of very kind of murder mystery. You know, there's the clue, and we're told that it's a clue, but there isn't an immediate kind of obvious, eh? What? And then as soon as you're told, you go, oh, yeah, of course. That makes perfect sense. And that's, again, that's just clever writing. Maybe that's a reference. I'm not a big Christie fan, so maybe that's like a reference to something or whatever. I don't know. But it's well done in this play. And I just really like those kind of little sort of subtle attentions to detail. And again, they help to sort of flesh out this idea of the Bursar as a sort of fully formed character, even when it's just an offhand detail like that.
And I also really like how the wheelchair aspect of her is never used for, like, pity. It's just this sort of scarring. And then we hear the horrible revelation of how it happened. it takes on sort of extra significance of like trapping her there. I think it's very aware of the sort of disability angle without being patronizing, but still using it for like a narrative and thematic purpose. And I really think that's smart.
Well, yeah, I think it's the fact that it's just treated so very matter-of-factly. So like early on in the play where the power goes out, she asks the doctor to come with her to go upstairs, and she has to use a chairlift to get up, because of course she does. And that's just such a matter-of-fact way of dealing with the fact that she has this disability. And you're right, the play never patronizes it for her, it never dismisses her for it, but it's also not, oh, so now I'm going to talk about a disabled person, because that's important. It's none of those things. It's just, this is a functional aspect of this character, and we will deal with it as this play demands. And that's exactly the correct way of handling it. It's such a refreshing way of having something like that integrated into this kind of story.
Speaking of disability handle not so well, let's pivot into, I think, the third character I'm burning to talk about, which is Sue/Ruth. Have her name the sort of settle on. The business with the rabbit is really good and creepy. I don't think they quite square the whole, however you say it, so well, because it's clear this is a trauma coping mechanism, and everyone's like, could you put the rabbit down? Ew. That's weird. I think they gild that a little too much with people have overreacting to it.
No, I think that's a perfectly fair judgment. And I don't know. I think maybe they slightly, I mean, they definitely do overplay it. I think Lizzie Simmons slightly hits it over the head a bit too much as well, in terms of the way that her performance sort of reacts to people trying to take the rabbit away from her. And that's slightly undermining. I don't think it does any sort of serious damage. And I think we sort of get the purpose of that. But it does get a bit over the top in places.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I like her rabbit voice, too. I think the sort of low gravelly voice is very both funny and creepy simultaneously in a way I really enjoy. I just think it's especially sort of weird that when this is clearly like a coping mechanism for her, one that in real life does work for some people, and then Ace and Hex are all like, ugh, that's weird, what are you doing that for? I'm like, oh, come on, let her have the rabbit. It's creepy, but I mean, you've seen worse.
Well, and especially because Hex explicitly states that at one point. Starts to explain it, and then he says, no, I understand what this is. It's a coping mechanism. This is what some people use, and it allows them to speak through another voice and sort of communicate their sort of fears or their insecurities without it being something that they have to sort of confront head on. So it's explicitly stated within the play. And then we still have, this is a bit weird. So, yeah, it does slightly mishandle that. It's definitely one of the admittedly very few weeds that there are here.
Yeah, but I do really think Lizzie Hopley is good as Ruth. Like, especially those last two episodes sort of bring her to the forefront as she's realizing her history. And I guess she already knows the history a little bit going in, but especially connecting to her father, Dr. O'Neill, it's so lovely the way those scenes are played. And their sort of slow reconnection. That's another great thing about this play is it's this very gruesome horror story that's constantly filled with dread, and there's so many great, lovely moments like that. Like the banter moments between Ace and Hex mentioned earlier, and then this little side plot with Ruth and her father. It's so gently played and so lovingly handled, and it gets such a nice, sweet ending for those two as opposed to every other guest character in the story that it does such a good... I'm really impressed how all those tones are sort of coexisting in the story.
Yeah, it's a really difficult balance to strike. And the fact that there is that sort of sweetness, that there is that grace note there, I think is one of the things that stops us just tipping over into sort of self-indulgence or sort of gratuitous use of sort of horror tropes or whatever. It does give some purpose to this, some reason for things to sort of reconnect. And the development of that relationship, I think, is sort of really key to realizing the fact that this exists for a purpose. This isn't just a gratuitous excuse to play around in these sort of genre tropes. There's something more. There's an emotional core to the story, and that sort of recovery and that sort of reconnection that sort of Sue/Ruth has is what drives that, and I think really, really effectively.
Well, I mean, we've been having mostly natural transitions so far, but I think I have to do a hard cut into something we have to talk about, which is the monster of the story, which is, for all intents and purposes, a zombie, a revenant, I believe the doctor refers to her as. It's a Yeah, it's great. I think it's very creepy. I think it does a good job not tipping its hand in the beginning. It's been long enough since I listened to this play. I sort of forgot the story behind it. So I was sort of assuming the person in the hoodie, which is set up very well, like could have been Ruth, could have been the Major, who I did sort of remember was part of the villain of the story. But it could also be something supernatural. And I think what the story does so well is really leading you and sort of eliminating, as Sherlock Holmes put it, eliminating the possible until only the impossible remains. And I think that way the mystery is set up is so good. And also just think the whole, everything with the zombie, the heavy breathing, the tape recording, the hoodie, the happy voice at the end, everything about it is so wonderfully creepy.
I think the realization of it is absolutely terrific. There is such a great, like, again, we're sort of following back on things we don't do. The production here is really stunning. It's so good at sort of evoking this kind of atmosphere. And I think the way that the zombie or revenant or whatever we're going to call it is realized in terms of the sort of the audio picture, as it were, is just fantastic. It's really just so well done. It's impossible not to kind of get creeped out by it. The actual time travel logic of the zombie, that doesn't make a lick of sense. I still don't understand that. Even sort of re-listening to it, I think this is probably the second or third time I've re-listened to the story. None of that convinces. But the realization of it is so good that it kind of over, that's where the symbolic logic breaks down. I can't quite justify the zombie in terms of sort of symbolic logic or whatever. But the realization of it is so well done, and the way that characters react to it, and the way that it sort of builds after the reveal, it almost sort of doesn't really matter that it doesn't make a lick of sense, because it's just done so well that it's impossible not to just get caught up in the whole aspect and atmosphere of it anyway.
The way that time travel works in this story plays faster and looser with Doctor Who's sense of time travel than most Doctor Who stories that are playing very fast and loose with its own internal continuity. But I guess this idea that some time machines just aren't as powerful enough to create paradoxes than others is just, yeah, it's complete nonsense. But yeah, it's really effective almost because it is complete nonsense. Like, this idea of a phantom, an echo, that will cause this corpse to twitch because of something unresolved in the time stream. And that, so, like, you really don't know what is going on. Like, I'm very confused about the explanation about it, but the confusion almost helps because that makes it almost straight up supernatural. Like, without any sort of explanation or reason, and that makes it all the scarier. There's no reversing polarity that can stop this thing. It's just been reanimated through some strange property that clearly the audience doesn't understand. And that, I think, makes it more effective.
Well, I sort of say that symbolic logic kind of breaks down when it comes to the zombie. That's sort of not quite true, because given that this is so wrapped up in the idea that it's a ghost story, it's so invested in sort of that part of its own construction, that's really what it is, that's what it's leading towards. And it's almost sort of sapphire and steel, if I can sort of go in that direction as well, and the actions of the past which sort of affect the present but not exactly in the way that you expect them to. That's a very kind of sapphire and steel way of dealing with time travel and the way, the sort of interconnectedness of events, let's say. And I can completely forgive it, because even if it doesn't make quite symbolic logic, even if it doesn't quite make sense in sort of Doctor Who's sort of traditional time travel or changing causality kind of modes, in the end, honestly, I just don't care, because it's done so well and so effectively that it carries it off. And to sort of loop things back around to Ghostlight as well, I mean, I think there are sort of some questions which you could maybe call out on the exact sort of narrative or plot logic of the way that episode 3 of Ghostlight resolves, but in the end, I don't care. Like, Ghostlight is a top 5 story for me as far as the original Doctor Who series goes, and I wouldn't change a single line, a single syllable in that entire production. And that's kind of how it is here. I know that if I really kick in my rational part of my brain, I know it doesn't quite make sense, but I don't care because it's just handled so exquisitely well.
Yeah, speaking of symbolic logic, I love that this is a creation of Major Dickens' own. Like, this is what he's trying to do, is create this revenant. And then it sort of comes after him and his colleagues who are also helping him in a very sort of retributive way. I mean, like I said, it was his idea. It's J.J. Bartholomew's machine. It's Hartley's reanimation. And the Deacon is, I suppose, really is just there to help things along. But she, I guess, fails to offer the moral clarity someone in her position should. And all of those combined, that's it. It leads to their own downfall. It's a slasher movie where you want to see them get killed. And that is so, like, satisfying in a symbolic way, that this is something created by their own mistake. Like, they tried to create this, like, almost Frankenstein in a way. They tampered with science they didn't understand, and because of that, it comes to get them back. And that's why it works. Like, not for the weird time travel technobabble, but for the symbolic sort of underpinning that this is something they created and it has to take them out because they tamper with things they don't understand.
Yeah, I think Frankenstein is probably another very good sort of story to reference there. And sort of with the chemical, with the sort of Gravenax poisoning as well, that sort of hints even slightly at sort of Jekyll and Hyde. And there's so much, like, even the setting of this, which is like an island, the fact that it's not revealed to be an island, I think it's more or less at the end of part two, I think it's revealed to be an island. That's such an effective little play, because that's just such a, you know, we're so used to windswept moors or, you know, isolated houses or bases under siege or whatever. It's just such a nice little detail that it's an island that they're stuck on. It very subtly, but very deliberately and very deeply sort of changes the stakes of what's going on. There's not going to be a rescue. They can't sort of run to the nearest town or village or whatever it is. You know, they're really kind of isolated out there. And like the whole thing with the Gravenax poisoning, maybe people are aware of this. I don't really know. But there were a few islands which were used in the north of Scotland during World War II where anthrax was tested as a potential weapon, which were off limits for very long periods of time until the disease died out. And that the idea that this island was sort of used for the testing of Gravenax kind of really plays into that as well. And then when you have the major, somebody of military rank, and all these kind of regrets and whatever, it adds another kind of dimension to the play. And that's just doing something as simple as choosing a very specific setting. So even those kind of details all feed into this kind of atmosphere and this kind of almost oppressive weight that we have within this. And I love all those kind of details in this.
Yeah, I did not know that about the anthrax testing. And that is another great context that shows how much is going on with the story sort of under the surface. And it really does sort of reward the sort of reevaluation. And I'm just, very glad Big Finish got its chance. I guess you could argue this is sort of like the Zerowith lost story they put out. And I mean, that range has its ups and downs, but it's also very nice that they sort of preserved these Doctor Who artifacts and had them reperformed. And this is no exception. I think it almost benefits from a rewrite in the way that some of those lost stories of that range could have. Because like incorporating Hex and sort of extending it from four episodes from the original plan three, allowing it for the more gruesomeness that Big Finish allows as opposed to BBC, I think all of these really improve the story, and I'm really glad they got Edward Young got the chance to put it out here like this.
Well, I think that's an absolutely perfect button to put on this story. Fantastic. Kev, would you care to tell people how they can get in touch with us?
Sure. You can email us about this story, anything Doctor Who related, and also I think we'll field questions about anything at this point, as long as they're not too weird. We could use some more emails to talk about on these episodes. So, please email us at talkingwhotoyou@gmail.com and reach out to us on Twitter at talkingwhotoyou. You can find me on Twitter at Kev Koeser, that is KevKoeser. And you can find more of JG's writings at www.jgmcquarrie.scott, that is JGMCQUARRIE.scott. Please like, rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast using whatever podcatcher you're using. That helps other people find the podcast and gives us the feedback we want.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Now, normally at this point, I would announce what we are going to be covering next week. But there isn't going to be a next week. Mau, don't panic. That doesn't mean that we're not coming back. It just means that we're taking a short break. So we're going to be off the air for around a month or so. And after that, we shall be returning. We hope that this is not going to diminish your interest. And of course, we hope that you're going to come back and join us when we discuss our next big Finnish play. But until then, keep talking.